Gillette's Best Blades can save you up to 50% versus the other Shave Club's $9 per month plan. That's right. Close, comfortable, smooth, and up to 50% off versus the other Shave Club. Join today at GilletteShaveClub.ca.
It's At The Letters, Sportsnet's Blue Jays podcast with Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson-Smith.
It's At The Letters for March 22nd. That is a Tuesday in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, on Sportsnet.ca and on iTunes. Please like, share, favorite, and subscribe. My name is Arden Zwelling, joined as always by Ben Nicholson-Smith. Ben, what's going on?
Not a whole lot. Things are getting close, getting real.
We've been saying that for weeks, but sure.
I think it actually is now.
I don't know. What, we got 2 weeks left?
Yeah.
When's opening day?
He'll be in Montreal for the final series.
But that's still fake baseball. That's still not real. But we're less than 2 weeks from opening day. So that's nice.
It's always good.
That's okay. Once we're in the single digits, then I'll feel good about it. But no one cares about that. What people care about is that we have a very special guest here today. This man is the pride of Oakville, Ontario. He has been covering this team for probably longer than he wants me to mention right now. The former play-by-play man of the Toronto Blue Jays, current host of Blue Jays Central, Jamie Campbell. Jamie.
Arden, here's what I'm concerned about.
What's that?
Why did you have to identify Ontario and Canada in your introduction? Do we have listeners in Tanzania?
We got listeners across the globe, all right? We got some reach. ATL reaches out all over the place. I don't know. It's just kind of the way I do it. I don't know why.
No, it's great to be here, though. It's wonderful to be here.
Yeah, it's good. There's other Ontarios, right?
Could be. There's Ontario, California, home of Prince Fielder, I believe.
Really?
Yeah.
I believe there's a speedway in Ontario, California, too. So,
Someday we'll be doing this show in California, and we'll be much happier people.
Why? Because the Blue Jays have relocated? Is that what you're talking about?
Because I've relocated.
Good luck with that.
And I don't have to deal with this misery for 6 months every year. But you like the winter, I take it.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. Yes. I love this country. I mean, we could do an entire hour on that alone. I would. you'll never see me living in the United States anytime soon.
All right, fair enough. Well, hey, thanks for coming along.
Maybe I should take that back if we have listeners not only coast to coast, but cross border as well.
I may have embellished that a little bit.
Okay.
Like, probably 99% of our listeners are like within like the GTA.
Okay.
I would say. Yeah, for sure. So, you know, you were down in Florida. Mm-hmm. I think we were down there. Oh, yeah, we did the car wash.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're down
there. I didn't have to lend you a suit this time.
You did not. You did not have to lend me a suit.
Arden has never heard the end of that.
Oh, my God.
Many times.
Every single person.
All the promotional shots you see of Arden last season in any form, whether it's magazine or television, he's wearing my suit because he was never told to bring a suit for those productions. And you fit into it nicely, I might add.
It's a great suit.
It's a little snug.
Finely tailored suit.
Yeah.
Yeah, finely tailored suit. Yeah, I'm actually surprised that maybe you wear yours a bit bigger than, and
I'm a little slimmer than you are. Just a touch.
Then how would I fit in that suit?
Perfectly.
I know, but so maybe I guess you get yours fitted a bit bigger, man.
Yeah, I'm like those new style ball players who like the pajama look. That's how I wear my suits.
I like it all form fitting. You know, you got to show off the figure. You spend all this time working on it. You got to show it off.
Well, you took probably a dozen people came up to you and made mention of the fact that you were wearing your own suit this year.
This year, every single person, like, oh, is that Jamie's suit? Is that Jamie's suit? Hilarious. It got funny every time. It got funnier.
It's funny for me.
And wait till people see the shirt that Jerry Howarth is wearing.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
During the promos.
Mm-hmm.
It's, yeah. Boy, it's bright.
It's a statement.
It is a statement shirt. Yes.
It's a statement shirt. We like to make statements. For once, Sonny wasn't the most flamboyantly dressed.
No, Jerry Howarth led the sartorial parade in that respect.
So what I was getting at was you're in Florida.
Yeah, we're going to talk some baseball or fashion here.
You were down there in Florida. What did you take away from Jays camp this year? What were your, you know, what did you bring back?
I took a few things away. One, I have not been down there and noticed how quickly and easily prepared so many players are for the start of the season. And I'm talking about late February. And I know they all are. I know this is modern day Major League Baseball where position players, more so than pitchers, are always seemingly ready to go from the time they show up for physicals. But it was so evident this year, and maybe that's because I was in communication with a lot of the guys in the off season, and I knew what they were doing before they even set foot in Dunedin. That was a huge takeaway. The Troy Tulowitzki situation was a takeaway for me as well, in that here is a guy that, like many people, I wondered, how is he going to acclimatize to being a Toronto Blue Jay? And did he like being one for that 3 months of last season? And it certainly appeared that he did. I'm no longer concerned about whether, I don't give a rat's derriere about whether a big league ball player likes it or not here. You're in the big leagues, suck it up. And Troy Tulowitzki did, and blended in beautifully late season. His numbers offensively weren't where we'd want them to be, but he was tremendous defensively. And I think now that he is more comfortable as a Blue Jay, I think you're going to see great things from him. The third thing I took away, and maybe you guys can expand on this, after all those moves were made mid-season last year, the consensus was that the Blue Jays farm system is depleted and there's nothing left in the cupboard. But I saw Connor Green, and I saw Anthony Alford, and I saw Rowdy Tellez, and I saw Roman Fields, and I saw, you know, Sean Reed Foley, and I saw a lot of kids that I think eventually the Blue Jays are going to utilize at the major league level or utilize in trade, depending on how things go this year and next. I'm not absolutely convinced, and you can read all you want about the, you know, the great farm systems currently in place in the major leagues and Baseball America, wherever you get your information. And I know the Blue Jays are not highly ranked in that category right now, but boy, oh boy, they gave up a lot last year to make that run. They still have a lot of very good prospects that are going to have an impact eventually.
I think they'd like to have some prospects closer to the major league level right
now. No question about that.
A lot of those guys are a ways away, and I think we're not going to see guys kind of rushed through the, you know, the minors like we have seen in the past, right?
But the guys that probably should be close now are already here. Sanchez, Osuna,
yeah.
Stroman. I mean, you're utilizing them now. So there is some time to wait for some of these kids to come. And a guy like Connor Green, I mean, I could see him making an impact at some point in 2016. At some point.
It's not crazy. It's definitely not crazy. You know, you look at 98 miles an hour, and that's a pretty good starting point for any pitcher, that's for sure. Even a guy like Pompey, who I think that a lot of people, you know, they don't necessarily count him among the starters. They don't necessarily count him among the prospects. But the reality is, at his age, he's someone who still can contribute in a big way.
Maybe people got a little bit spoiled by the amount of prospects there were under Alex Anthopoulos for a number of years. I mean, this system was pretty low. Like, we're talking a top 10 mm-hmm. system in the majors, and that's why he had that capital to trade for David Price, trade for Troy Tulowitzki, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe, you know, maybe people got a little bit spoiled by having that many, because you look at how well that 2010 draft went, and then there was that year that they had like five picks, and maybe it was the same year. They had five picks in the first like 77 or something crazy like that. Like, that's a lot of high-end talent coming in, but I do think they're replenishing the farm system is absolutely has to be a priority going forward, because the, you know, the system is, if it was top 10, it's kind of flipped to probably bottom 10.
Oh, it certainly has. Depending on who you pay attention to in that respect, it's certainly not in the top 20,
yeah,
in fact, right now. But of course, as we know, prospects are entirely unpredictable. I don't care, you know, where you're ranked by which publications,
yeah,
it doesn't guarantee that you're ever going to become a star. For every Bryce Harper, there's Jeff Clement, right? There's going to be failures, there's going to be success stories, and we need to wait until these players prove themselves at the big league level. I sound like Greg Zahn. Prove themselves at the big league level before we give them any kind of credibility.
Well, that also speaks to the fact, though, that for, you know, them having a Connor Green and Sean Reed Foley, Anthony Alford, that, like, you know, maybe only one of those guys works out, maybe none of those guys work out. Like, I've always been in favor of, you know, when people say, oh, how can you trade Jeff Hoffman? How can you trade Daniel Norris and that? You know, trade the prospect.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let him go. Like, they sure have the most value, yeah, now, because it's really perceived value in a sense. Like, you still haven't seen them get it done in the major league. Like, I much more value a guy like Marcus Stroman, who has shown me over, you know, 25 starts in his career, whatever it's been, that he can get major league hitters out, rather than a guy who, you know, has been great in the minor leagues, but I haven't seen him do it in the majors yet.
I don't know a single person who loves the Blue Jays who's crying about the loss of Hoffman and Norris and Barreto and all of those kids. I don't know one person who went through that 3 months and then that run through the playoffs to the American League Championship Series that really wishes those prospects were still in the system. Not one, because, you know, that process the Blue Jays went through of getting rid of all those kids and fortifying a very good team and finally getting to the postseason after all those years was so meaningful to so many people. Who cares what happens to the rest of these kids that end up leaving the organization? If Jeff Hoffman wins 5 Cy Young Awards, good for the Rockies. You know, we had 2015.
Exactly. And it wouldn't be that surprising necessarily if a guy like Hoffman or Norris or Barreto goes out and becomes a big league all-star. And in fact, I mean, the Blue Jays have seen that already with Noah Syndergaard. In that case, it didn't work out at the big league level, but they know that pain. At least this time, they know that they've gotten something in return for it. So I think that adds up.
I think people are starting to cry with Noah Syndergaard. I think maybe not even just starting so much as they are when they see what that, you know, he's going to be at the front of the Mets rotation, or like at least one of the better pitchers on the New York Mets this year, it seems. And what he did last year, when you look at that fastball and you look at the life he has, and you look at the arm and just everything that he's done. I mean,
give it time. But those people that cry, I get that. I get it. Believe me, I'd love to have Noah Syndergaard in this organization. But at the time, it was a necessary situation. It was a deal that was made because the Blue Jays were tired of being mediocre. They'd swung the huge deal with the Marlins. Josh Johnson was coming. Mark Burley was coming. Jose Reyes was coming. Now, all of a sudden, you have a chance to get the 2012 Cy Young Award winner in the National League, and it's going to cost you Darnell and Syndergaard. Do it, right? It was a necessary move at the time, and remember how excited people were about the start of that season. I know it didn't finish well. I know it didn't evolve the way it was supposed to, but you remember that 2013, the lead up to 2013 was very similar to what we're going through right now. Mm-hmm. Very similar.
Yeah, except this has a legitimate playoff team behind it.
Back then it was on paper, right? On paper, this is quite possibly the best team in the American League. Now it's on paper, they've proven themselves as legit, and let's see what they can do after having the experience of getting to the postseason.
I even look to what happened to Josh Johnson. After, you know, I mean, in that season, like coming off of like how many great years with the Marlins and then coming to Toronto and just his career basically absolutely just crumbling.
Haven't seen him since.
In his first, he went to San Diego, tried to come back. I think he had Tommy John. That's a career that absolutely fell apart, but he was a great, great pitcher. And he was, lining up.
He was the key to that deal, frankly.
Yeah.
Hey, it was great to get Jose Reyes, and Mark Burley was nearing the end of his career, but Josh Johnson, as I recall, was the key to that deal. He was the guy that made you most excited about that 2013 season.
He was, for sure. And I think that the difference maybe between now and then is just that there's such a emphasis on building now, and they can kind of build from the 2015 season that was immensely successful and try to add on to that. Whereas in 2013, there were so many parts from so many different places, and there was this feeling that they had to create something. Here, it's already been created. Now they just have to add on, and whether they can do that or not, we'll find out in the next 6 months, but they have a legitimate shot.
I think one of the biggest things you're losing with, Alex Anthopoulos and Paul Beeston leaving, Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins coming in, is kind of that unpredictability and that kind of gunslingerness and like that, what, you know what I mean? Like the fun, really? I don't think we're going to see another Marlins trade from this, from this front office. I don't think we're going to see another deadline like we saw last year. Like, this is going to be a front office that's going to be very careful and very deliberate. And is going to develop and is going to, be just a bit, frankly, like more, I don't know if cautious is the word or if intelligent is the word, but there's a word out there that I can't find right now. But like, you're not going to see
a
little more conservative. You're not going to see those fun, holy crap deals anymore.
No, but you may see a mid-season deal that strengthens the ball club like it did last year again, because, as we discussed earlier, there are some players in that system that should be attractive to other clubs. Whether they are, I don't know, but should be based on some of the things I saw. And if that's the case, and the Blue Jays are in a position to get a frontline starter or, add a player of some value to help push themselves to the postseason in 2016, the cupboard is not bare. You know, there are players there that could be moved to help fortify this club.
I think we saw that with the Royals last year, where they kind of had a middling rotation for the most part, supported by an incredible bullpen, and they got to the midway point of the season, clearly in need of frontline starting pitching. They go out, they trade for Johnny Cueto. So even though the Blue Jays right now don't have an ace, they have Marcus Stroman, who has the potential to become an ace, but I don't think he's there now. And that leaves some to question the Blue Jays' rotation, but they can adjust midseason. They can trade guys like an Alford if they have to, or Rowdy Tellez, and acquire some frontline pitching help, because I think that's really necessary for a team that's trying to make that next push.
I was looking at it last night. It's funny to think that like David Price pitched for the Toronto Blue Jays. Like, you can almost forget about it. Like, it's all, you know what I mean? Like, it's almost like it never happened. But mm-hmm. David Price made 11 starts down there, and 11, like, really, really good starts.
Yes.
Say what you will about what happened in the playoffs, but like, he was phenomenal for the Blue Jays. David Price pitched for the Blue Jays. This man makes $217 million over the next 7 years or whatever it is.
Yeah, and the way things are going in Boston right now, he's about their only starting pitcher of value or so it seems. Like, hey, God bless him for getting the money he got, and good luck in Boston. You know, all I ever heard after that deal was consummated is that, you know, Boston wasn't exactly a first choice. And here's a guy who thrived in Tampa Bay, where you could walk the streets of St. Petersburg uninterrupted. Had a short stint in Detroit, and then came to Toronto, where he was beloved and loved the city, the country, his teammates back. Now, all of a sudden, David Price is in a position where you better not mess up. I mean, this is Boston, for goodness sake. And, you know, they're having some issues with numbers 2, 3, 4, and 5 in that rotation at this point, or so I am led to believe.
Well, I mean, Boston just blew everyone else out of the water in the bidding. So sure. This is what we've been led to believe through reporting, is that, they offered more than anyone else was going to offer, which, like, you can't fault a guy for taking that money, but I don't think Boston was ever the first choice. I don't think anyone really wants to play at Fenway Park, especially as a pitcher. Like, I don't really think you know what I mean? Like, you play in this kind of joke ballpark with weird dimensions. Like, it's, and you've been there. Like, it's not a fun place to even be, just to, like, breathe the air. Like, it's dank and dusty.
Really?
You
don't think some players would want to play there? If you're a right-handed power hitter, you've got to.
Yeah, not a pitcher.
I wonder.
If I'm a right-handed power hitter, yeah, absolutely. If I'm Edwin Encarnacion or Jose Bautista, sign me up.
Right.
I'll put dents into that monster.
I personally enjoyed everything about Fenway Park.
Really?
Yeah.
Don't you find it's dusty, it's dank, there's no airflow, visitors' clubhouse.
But it was built in 1912, for goodness sakes. What do you expect?
And it's 2016. We can do better.
You think
it would be like driving a Model T through Toronto. Like, you can do better.
Look, I look at things differently. I think that the modern day NHL, for example, is boring because there aren't any old barns around anymore that you can go to and feel like it's yesteryear. And that's the great thing about baseball. You can go to the modernized stadium, Safeco Field, Miller Park, U.S. Cellular, go to all the new ballparks you want, but you still have an opportunity, if you wish, to go to the north side of Chicago or go to Boston or go out to Los Angeles and go to Dodger Stadium and at least enjoy a ball game the way it's been enjoyed for decades. And I'm good with that. I don't want everything modernized, but that's me.
I feel like if I'm an elite athlete who's making millions and millions of dollars, and I'm like breathing in this centuries old dust, right?
You're big on the
stale beer that never seems to get into the sewers there. I know it, but
I think it's a good experience for a fan, right? Like, I think it's a cool thing for a fan to do. If you're a player and you have to play 81 days there, I mean, I think you'd get tired pretty quick.
Well, you're a Boston Red Sox, right? You're the toast of the town. You're getting paid handsomely, I assume, unless you're Travis Shaw, and suck it up, right? It's a team that's won 3 World Series in the last 10 years, so I don't think anybody on that side of the ledger would be complaining. On the visitor side, and I can only speak from my experiences there, you get into that tiny little clubhouse, one that Greg's on to test more than anything in this world, and I understand that, but then you get to walk down this tunnel, and I'm sure you guys have been down that tunnel. That's the same tunnel that Babe Ruth used to take to get to the field whenever they were at Fenway Park to face the Red Sox, right? And there's gigantic rats that are roaming down there from time to time, from what I've been told. I never actually saw one myself, and it smells like, one of those urinal cakes that you'd see in some grindy bar somewhere. But it's part of the mystique of Fenway Park. Same thing in Wrigley Field, and Wrigley Field is fascinating. There is a tunnel that goes from the visitors' dugout that stretches all the way back to the rear of the stadium. And at one point, you actually walk over the concession areas, and you don't know it because there are these tarps up there. But if you pull the tarps down, all the people are leaving the stadium underneath you, or if it's the beginning of the game, are buying their popcorn right below you. And that's the route that the visiting player has to take. It's wonderful. I think there's room in modern day baseball for old time things. I know I'm probably in the minority in this room saying that.
No, I think Ben's on your side.
Players would agree with you too, because you look at guys like John Lackey, obviously a pitcher, or David Price, who's a pitcher, or John Lester, who's seriously considered the Red Sox as obviously a pitcher, and hitters too, time and again, sign with the Red Sox, Hanley, Pablo Sandoval. So, and those are just in recent years, the last couple of seasons. I think people like players seem to like signing in Boston. They have money, they have history, they have usually a competitive team, and maybe the ballpark would be appealing to some and not others, but yeah, to me personally, I think that it offers a lot.
And the Cubs have not lacked for interested free agents, that's for sure. Certainly not recently.
I'll work in a sewer if you pay me enough. You know what I mean? Like, you give me enough money, like I'll work in some places. But yeah, the rats, you said the rats and the reek of urine are part of the mystique, basically.
I said the reek of stale beer. I never said urine. Smells like urinal cakes. You know, this, let's not go there.
I've never smelled a urinal cake.
My first time on ATL, I want to be invited back.
We could talk about urinal cakes. So this spring, like the Blue Jays, for a team that not much has changed, really, in terms of the roster. David Price leaves, Jay Happ comes in. Mm-hmm. Other than that, you're pretty much dealing with the same group of guys for the most part. A couple of, you know, Drew Storen's in the bullpen. But for there not being much movement, kind of the 25-man roster, there has been a ton of storylines.
Oh, my goodness, there have been. And movement, I think, or lack of, can be a good thing. You know, there's sometimes, and we saw this, 4 years ago now, when this brand new influx of players comes in and there's just something not right.
Yeah.
I love the fact that most of the players from last year are still part of this organization, and there's only been a couple of guys leave and a couple of guys come in. Storylines abound. And you know, this Encarnacion and Bautista storyline is going to be there all year long. You'll hear me utter the word distraction once on this podcast and never again, because I think it's
right,
highly overused in the media. But I personally don't think it's a big deal. Is it a big deal? Are the futures of those players a big deal? Absolutely, and should be, because one of them's an iconic figure and one of them's darn close in my estimation. Jose Bautista, I feel like you, should finish his career as a Blue Jay. Edwin Encarnacion, love the guy. I mean, I'm not going to cry if he goes somewhere else. Hopefully that's not Boston at the end of the year. But the Blue Jays have some huge deals that they're going to have to deal with in 2017 and 18 and 19. Troy Tulowitzki's making a lot of money. Russ Martin's making a ton of money. Josh Donaldson is going to, after his two-year contract is up. They may need starting pitching after R.A. Dickey goes away at the end of the season. You know, there are going to be expenses coming, and the organization has to determine which one of these guys they're keeping. Are they keeping both? Are both of them leaving? What are they going to do? It's a huge question, a big story, and frankly, one I'm happy I'm not involved in making.
Where do you think this leads with these guys? I mean, Bautista has said that he's apparently open to talking throughout the season, and Encarnacion sounds like we'll find out in the next couple of weeks. Where do you think it lands?
I don't buy this "we want something done by opening day" thing from Encarnacion's side. Are you telling me if they come to him midseason with a 5-year offer,
right,
at $125 million, he's not going to say, "Okay, I'll think about that," or no, "I'll test the free market"? He may. But I don't buy this, you have to have it wrapped up by opening day. I don't know where I side. I know where I side personally. I think I'd like to see Jose Bautista stay. I think he's done a ton for the organization. I think he's still a supreme baseball player on many levels. He might not be as defensively accomplished as he used to be. And I'm not saying bye-bye Edwin Encarnacion. If there's a way of keeping him too, great. But this lineup is so deep that I think they can afford to lose one of them. My preference would be that Encarnacion, or that Bautista stays, only because he's been in the middle of so many different iconic moments that I think it would be wrong to see him playing for the Detroit Tigers.
If I had to only choose one, that's the one I'd choose as well. And I think he's a truly unique player in this game in terms of being a champion for Latin America, in terms of being an ambassador for the game, a clubhouse presence, a mentor for young players. I mean, he's a truly unique guy. Mm-hmm. Like what you get out of Jose Bautista isn't just on the field. You know, it's off the field as well. It's with players in the clubhouse. It's with the community. It's with, you know, being just truly a legend of Toronto Blue Jays baseball. I mean, if he finishes his career in a Toronto Blue Jays or a uniform, they're going to be making money off of Jose Bautista for decades to come, off of bobbleheads and commemorative jerseys and events, and you bring him back to raise his name up to the thing and yada, yada. You know what I mean? Like, if he becomes kind of like a Robbie Alomar type, like a lifelong Blue Jay, I mean, you can be making money off this guy for a long, long, long time when you look at, you know, the upfront costs you're going to pay for what it's going to take to keep him here. But, I mean, it's interesting to talk to you about it because you were the play-by-play guy when Jose Bautista first came over. And we first started with the team. And I mean, the evolution of this guy. I mean,
incredible.
The guy that you got, you know, in 2008, I guess was when he came here. I mean, what was that? You know, what was he like?
Well, it was a nothing deal at the time. Yeah. Nobody paid it any mind. In fact, I remember watching Bautista play for the Pirates in spring training that year, thinking this guy looks like a pretty serviceable player here.
Right.
And then did a little research into him and noticed that they were, you know, moving him around in the field, weren't giving him a ton of at bats. I never thought, boy, we should go out and get this guy. I just thought, wow, they've got a pretty decent third baseman. And then when they gave up Robinson Diaz, I didn't think much of it because I didn't think much of Robinson Diaz. Yeah. But it was by no means a headline-grabbing deal. In fact, when it was made, I don't think anybody even bothered to mention it, save for, you know, the local radio station and quite possibly Sportsnet on the Late Show. But maybe even at that, they didn't.
What?
That's how small a deal it was at the time. And Edwin, as we recall, when he was acquired, was a throw-in that, frankly, the Blue Jays never wanted to, a contract the Blue Jays never wanted to assume in the first place.
In the Rowland trade. Right?
In the Scott Rowland deal. I mean, that was a situation where, okay, if this deal is going to be consummated, we have to take Edwin Encarnacion. I mean, that's how valued he was at that time. And look what he's turned into.
When you were talking to Jose Bautista around the batting cage, even in those days, and when you're kind of getting to know him as a ball player, I mean, it was pretty shy, pretty quiet guy from what I've been told. Yeah. I wasn't around at the time. Pretty reserved.
As fiercely proud as he is today, I will never forget, because when the Rowland deal was done, the Blue Jays were in Oakland and I was there with the club, and I will never forget walking into the visitors clubhouse in Oakland as the new players were coming in and seeing Edwin walk up to his locker, and there was the old style Encarnacion Blue Jays jersey hanging there, and feeling sorry and looking at the guy and thinking, I feel sorry for this guy because this is the one player in this deal that the Blue Jays don't want to have. Yeah. Like, I legitimately stopped and thought, oh man, what a position this guy must be in. And look at him now. I mean, he's done wonders for the organization. He's got followers from coast to coast. He's got incredible respect. He's garnered incredible respect for obvious reasons.
It's crazy.
Not to mention the E5 era. Sorry to cut you off, Ben. Like the era when fans hated him.
Yeah.
When he was playing third base and, you know, it seems like there was errors every night. And, you know, he's clearly mentally battling that failure.
I called him E5 one time on the air during a broadcast and realized how unfair it was to do that. Went up to him the next day and apologized.
Yeah.
And I remember what he said to me. He says, well, maybe you shouldn't have done it in the first place in broken right. English. And I thought, yeah, you're right, actually. And I apologize again. I'm sorry. Never hear me say it again.
Right.
Not fair.
When it comes to Bautista, we know him now as this guy who's so aware of his fitness and his body and the way that he treats himself and eats and everything like that. Was he like that at the time when he first came over here?
I don't remember, because he wasn't a major player, right? He wasn't Jose Bautista that we know today. He was a guy the Blue Jays were taking a chance on, who'd been from one organization to the next and they had some depth in the catcher position, and they decided to get rid of a guy they never thought was going to make much of a name for himself at the major league level in Diaz. I mean, I'm trying to think of a comparable player right now. It's like Junior Lake. How much do we know of Junior Lake, for example? And how much will we ever know? And in 3 years, will Junior Lake hit 54 home runs? Maybe.
Maybe.
Unlikely, though. So that's the comparable to me right now, is we knew as much about Jose Bautista then as we know about Junior Lake right now.
Crazy.
We have to step away for a quick break, but we'll pick this back up after this on At the Letters.
Wells bombs this to left field, and you can kiss that one goodbye. It's a one-run game.
It continues on At the Letters. Arden Zwelling here with Ben Nicholson-Smith. Very pleased to be joined by Jamie Campbell. We were just talking about Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion, their evolutions as ball players and, you know, in the Blue Jays uniform. I mean, you know, nobody could have expected that they were ever going to become. It's incredible that the Blue Jays have had two guys like this who they've kind of picked up just, you know, on whims. You know, Edwin Encarnacion, as Jamie said, like, not a guy the Blue Jays ever really wanted. Jose Bautista's deal, like, totally, like, minor move. And then they become these guys who are now going to command contracts in the, you know, $20 to $30 million range. Like, it shows you how quickly things can change.
Mm-hmm.
And now,
and Edwin twice, remember that, right? Edwin, they didn't want him the first time, and then they waived him.
Yeah.
Again, what, in 2011, I think it was.
And Oakland took him. Yeah.
And then they left him unprotected.
They non-tendered him.
And then the Blue Jays got him right back. Incredible.
Crazy.
This game it's crazy. So to have Josh Donaldson as another guy who really was like a 4A player not that long ago in his in his life, right? Like, who a late, you know, total late bloomer, a guy who's now become an MVP winner after, you know, struggling to make Oakland's roster and being like bounced between AAA and the majors. I mean, it's to have this collection. Have you ever seen a collection of, you know, stories like this?
What's it say about the Oakland A's? I mean, had Edwin, right? They had Edwin. And they had Josh Donaldson.
Yeah.
And look, hey, I liked Brett Laurie, all right? I didn't think much of Sean Nolan. We didn't know him well enough to know much about him. Barreto might end up as a wonderful player at some point. But when that deal was done, I could not believe it.
Really?
When that Donaldson acquisition was made, I stood there and thought, you have got to be kidding me. What on earth are the Oakland A's doing? And thank goodness he's coming to our team. Insane. It's an incredible lineup, guys. It really is.
It's nuts. And I think that for all of the attention that the July 31st deals got last year, and rightfully so, David Price and Troy Tulowitzki, even some of the lesser deals, Ben Revere and Mark Lowe, I mean, really, the deal that set it all up was Donaldson, and that's probably, if not, well, I think that's probably the best trade Anthopoulos made as a Blue Jays GM.
I'd say so, off the top of my head, probably.
Some of it, to me, comes from this notion that Alex Anthopoulos touched on late last season, and that was, there was a point where he stopped worrying about the talent of a player and started being a little more concerned about the character of a player. And I think there were some past drafts that came to bite him. And I don't want to lay it all on the Dec McGuire draft, but that might have been one of those picks that made him realize, you know what, stop thinking about players in terms of what they're physically capable of doing and start thinking a little more toward who they are and what it is they want to accomplish in professional baseball. And you've seen that now. And I've been around long enough now to have remembered when the character of the player was never really a massive consideration, because people ask me all the time, what are these players like? And I can't say a bad thing about any member of the 2016 Blue Jays. But if you shuffled back to, say, 07, I could pick five or six guys. And I'm talking from a media to player perspective, understandably. But if you're a rotten human being, it's got to say something about, you know, the way you perceive yourself and the way you attack your profession. I mean, every single one of these guys, and I know you both deal with them, is a straight up reasonable, polite, approachable in many respects. I mean, Troy Tulowitzki doesn't say much, but Troy Tulowitzki carries himself the same way Roy Halladay did, where, hey, if you need 15 minutes, come and see me prior to the game tomorrow, and I'll give you 15 minutes. But otherwise, I'm here to do a job. And I love that. Like, I used to give Roy Halladay a ton of space because I knew how he approached his job. And I see a lot of Blue Jays right now, today, that behave that way, whose main focus is, what do I need to do to win this game tonight? And that's been a huge change in philosophy in the organization. I remember those days in the mid-2000s when, man, there were guys in that roster who you just knew didn't want to be there, but they were making these huge salaries and they were putting in their time and they were trying to build up their numbers, and winning was in many cases the furthest thing from their minds.
I think you look at that, how that has an effect on younger players on their roster, and you look at the way that, you know, reflects on Marcus Stroman, on Aaron Sanchez, Roberto Osuna, who's just 20 years old, right? On some of the young, you know what I mean? Like, that's how you kind of build a culture. And that's how you kind of build a, you know, and these things can be kind of nebulous and they can, you know, they're intangible and, you know, it's kind of like a chicken and egg thing. What comes first, winning or, you know, clubhouse chemistry or whatever. But I mean, part of me wants to like say that it's overrated, but you talk to anybody in the game and they're like, no, it exists. It's for real. And it's an actual thing that helps us be successful and is a very impactful part of this team's success. And I can't deny that. When 25 guys on a roster are saying it.
Yeah, I wonder too, when you zoom out beyond clubhouse chemistry to the complete organizational level, and we touched on it a bit before with the idea that they have a new team president here, and Jamie, for most, if not all the time that you have been covering the team, Paul Beeston was running the show. Have you noticed any kind of difference between Shapiro and the way he runs things as opposed to the way Beeston did, and for so long with Anthopoulos as his top baseball guy?
I haven't noticed anything on field, and I doubt we'll notice anything on field until next year and beyond. I don't think much is going to change in that respect. The way they go about their business is going to change, I'm sure. Certainly with all the different shuffling that's gone on in the upper ranks of management, especially on the baseball side, things are going to change oh so subtly. But I don't think enough has changed for us to even notice it. You'll probably see people come and go in the next couple of seasons, people who had a major impact on the decisions Alex Anthopoulos was making, but I don't know. I'll throw it back at you guys. I haven't seen anything on the field beyond this push for, you know, a facility in Dunedin that is as top notch as can possibly be. And some of those little decisions that they're pushing toward in the future, I haven't noticed a thing.
A lot of what they're doing, you're going to see it in like 5 years. Like once you get this new draft class in this year and then next year's draft class, which might have two pretty high first round compensatory picks in it. Once you get those new players in and once you get them into the system and through the high performance and really like developed properly and, you know, and meticulously and slowly and brought along in much the same way Aaron Sanchez was, like, Aaron Sanchez is kind of maybe the one prospect the Blue Jays haven't rushed who's on the major league roster right now that I can think of. Like Marcus Stroman, I came out of college but went pretty quickly to the big league roster. Roberto Osuna came up at 20. Who else, right? Like,
Pompey.
I mean, sorry? Pompey. Like, you know, like, it, you know, a lot of these guys were like worked through the system pretty quickly. We're not going to see that anymore. So I think that the changes they're implementing now, yeah, you're not going to see them for like half a decade. But they could be substantial. Like it's a new way of thinking, the way they're doing it, with a focus on sports science, with a focus on mental health, with a focus on nutrition and on, you know, tailoring conditioning plans to specific individual players. Each guy gets his own way of doing things, whether it's, you know, how much long toss you play or, you know, how you ramp up your arm or, you know, how much BP you take or, you know, what you do away from the field, kind of lifting you do, you know, with all this stuff, you'll see it start to come to fruition in a while.
For all the venom that was spewed in the direction of Mark Shapiro and Ross Adkins at the time of their hiring, it's tough to complain now about the direction this team is taking with respect to some of these things, high performance and rehabilitation and improvement of the existing facility in Dunedin. And the fact that, you know, they were so impressed with with the way Marcus Stroman recovered from his injury. And you know more about this, that they ended up hiring most of the people that helped him recover, right? I mean, how can you complain about the direction that the new regime has taken? It's pretty tough. And you know they're going to get a little heat if they get off to a lousy start. Not going to be their fault, but someone has to be the villain, so it'll center on Shapiro and Atkins and maybe to a degree John Gibbons. But in terms of the professionalism and the preparation and the plans that are being made for future years, how can you argue with how can you be disappointed with what they're trying to accomplish?
It's very wide-ranging, too. Even if you look at the big league stadium, the spring stadium, you have players at the big league level, minor league players. You're looking ahead to free agency. They are doing high-performance work. So it's all-encompassing. And when you think back to Atkins being on the job for 3 months and Shapiro being on the job for 5 months, that's a pretty compressed period of time. And already we've seen some hints at change. And I agree, Jamie, that it's not necessarily change that's all that tangible, but you can start to get a sense of the direction that change will head in.
All right, we're going to step away for a quick break, but more coming up after this with myself, Arden Zwelling, with Bennison Smith, and with very special guest Jamie Campbell on At The Letters.
That's blasted, and she ain't coming back. Hello, Matt Stairs, a home run. Well, Pat, there's your slump buster.
It continues on At The Letters. Arden Zwelling with Ben Nixon-Smith and Jamie Campbell in studio. We're on sportsnet.ca, also on iTunes. Please like, share, favorite, and subscribe if you want to leave us a review. If you want to leave us a number of stars, the number I would pick is 5, but I'll leave it up to you. If you want to do that, that'd be very helpful to us. And we always appreciate hearing your feedback. I'm at Arden Zwelling on Twitter. Ben's at B Nixon-Smith. Jamie's at SNet Campbell. To go in a completely different direction, Jamie, we were talking about Canada earlier, and the Blue Jays played the junior national team the other day. It's a great day. Looked like a fantastic time. Greg Hamilton runs a great program there, and, you know, guys go down, and you know, you're starting to see some guys developed out of there. Dalton Pompey came out of there, and his brother as well. Do you feel that the Blue Jays, they've lost Paul Beeston and Alex Anthopoulos, two Canadians who were at pretty, you know, significant, had pretty significant roles in the front office, replaced by Americans. Paul Beeston and Alex Anthopoulos had shown a willingness to draft Canadian players and to give Canadian players a chance. Do you think the Blue Jays have that responsibility to invest in Canadian players and to, you know, try to develop them where they can?
I don't. Yeah. I'm going to take another side of your comment in saying that I don't think the Blue Jays have ever had a very good record of drafting and developing Canadians. Now, Dalton Pompey is a recent example.
Yeah.
Brett Laurie, of course, was acquired by trade, so he wasn't drafted by the Blue Jays.
I'd look at Tom Robson as a guy.
Tom Robson, you know, may or may not have a future. I believe he was a fourth-round pick, and he's gone through Tommy John surgery, so there might be a time when we see him play a role. But you think of all the great players that this country has produced, Justin Morneau and Joey Votto and Larry Walker, and players that were never ever identified by the Blue Jays. Joey Votto in their own backyard, I might add.
Right.
Never identified by the Blue Jays. So I would take a bit of an opposite route and say, I don't think the Blue Jays have ever done a very good job of drafting Canadians. I think in time that will change, because I firmly believe, based on what I've seen coast to coast, with the accent now on baseball among so many young people in this country, it's pretty evident when the weather's nice, you know, if you walk by a ball field, it's usually packed with kids wanting to play baseball. I'm sure the playoff run had a lot to do with that. I'm sure there'll be more opportunity in future years, because kids are going to say, hey, I want to be a big league ball player instead of a player in the National Hockey League or play in the NBA or whatever it might be. But the association with Greg Hamilton and his people at Baseball Canada has been strong only in the last 5 to 10 years. Whether or not that benefits the Blue Jays, time will tell. I mean, they didn't get Josh Naylor. The Miami Marlins did, right? They didn't get Mike Soroka. The Atlanta Braves did.
Right.
So if I don't think the Blue Jays should focus on drafting a player because of his passport. I really don't. Draft Marcus Stroman because you think Marcus Stroman's going to be an impact player at the major leagues. Don't draft a kid because he was born in Canada.
What do you think, Ben?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And you look at guys like Russell Martin, who they end up getting, but not by drafting him. If you're a baseball team, you want to do well in the draft, obviously. And if that means acquiring Canadians who can have an impact at the big league level, then you're that much better off. It would be great to see. And I think that, you know, whether it's the next Joey Votto, the next Russell Martin, if the Blue Jays can do that, that would be great for them. But I would agree, too, that it's not a responsibility. I think, in a sense, they're embracing a responsibility that they don't necessarily have. But they're taking it on to some mm-hmm. extent.
Their responsibility indirectly is to help promote the game in this country right. and help establish the game as a passion among young people in this country. But ultimately, their focus should be on making their major league team as good as it possibly can be. And if that means passing up a Canadian in the draft to take an American who's better, do it.
100%.
Every time.
Right. I look at 2012, four Canadians drafted, none of them in the higher rounds, but I feel like that, and I'm like furiously scrambling through draft records right now, but like, I feel like there's been a trend in later rounds.
Hey, look, there's a ton of them, like, late round picks. Yeah. I was down at the minor league facility watching seven players do some stretching, and five of them walked up to me and stuck their hands out and introduced themselves. And yeah. they were all Canadians. It was Connor Panis. It was Mike Reeves. It was Tom Robson. It was Mattingly Romanen. There are lots of Canadians, in the system, but none of them have been, you know, Pompey was a high pick. Robson was a fourth rounder. I think Panis went in the ninth round. Yeah. I mean, you know, most of them are sort of in the latter rounds of the draft. And that's great. You want to stock the system and hope like heck a kid like Pompey, yeah. as he has, who was a 16th rounder, yeah. turns into be major league caliber. Great. But not at the expense of trying to improve your club in 3 or 4 or 5 years. Right. You go after in that first couple of rounds what you think is going to be beneficial to you, and do it because of talent, not because of passport.
I guess I feel the Blue Jays have a responsibility to the country of Canada to
draft and develop?
In a way, a little bit.
Really?
Yeah. I don't think you need to reach for a guy. I don't think you need, but like, I think that players in those later rounds who aren't going to get, maybe aren't getting opportunities with other clubs, I think if you're rolling the dice on a guy, roll the dice on the Canadian before
okay.
the American.
Yeah.
For me,
in the 25th round, I'm good with that.
Yeah.
But you don't take a player in the first or second third round.
No.
Right.
I don't want to build this team.
And they've
of
done
all
that.
Canadians.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't
they've
want them
done
to, yeah. Because I do think when you look at the way this country was, and it was the first time I saw it last year during that push to the playoffs, then into the playoffs, when you had like 1 in 3, 1 in 4 Canadians watching the Blue Jays every night of the week. Like that means there is phenomenal interest mm-hmm. in this sport in Canada, and you don't see it play out in mm-hmm. terms of elite high level talent going to be professional ball players
right.
out of Canada. Like, you just don't see it. So like, what's the disconnect there? You know what I mean? Why do people love this sport so much, but people aren't, you know what I mean? But they aren't. So I do think the Blue Jays kind of have a bit of a responsibility to develop, you know what I mean? To at least to, you know, cause that's one way they can affect it, right? Is by, especially if you're going to be trying to run like a cutting edge state of the art minor league system in
right.
the coming years and development system, you know, over those last like 20 rounds of the draft, like, roll the dice in the Canadian kid rather than the American kid.
And they may have tried in the first round too. We just will never know. I think in 2008, Brett Laurie, who I believe was taken 17th overall, was taken by the Brewers one pick before the Blue Jays. So maybe they would have taken him. I think they took David Cooper instead, as I recall. I think Brett Laurie went one pick before the Blue Jays. I also believe Mike Soroka went one pick last year by the Braves before Jonathan Harris went. So we'll never know. Maybe the Blue Jays wanted to select Brett Laurie in 2008, and maybe they wanted to select Soroka last year. We won't know.
I think it's tricky when you start talking about the Blue Jays, and they're a business. I mean, they're not here for the benefit of Canadian baseball now or in the future. That's Baseball Canada's job, and the Blue Jays have an obligation to win as many games as they can and to try to essentially live up to that business side of things. They're not a pro bono organization trying to build grassroots baseball in Canada. But I do think that especially when you're talking about the number of jobs involved too. If you have a GM's reputation on the line, if you have a scouting director's reputation on the line, an amateur scout, I'm not sure that those people should be asked to set aside their own background to make a pick that would benefit Canadian baseball.
Mm-hmm. You know what the Blue Jays are doing for Canadian baseball right now? Just by being successful.
Yeah.
Registration's up. More kids are picking up gloves and bats and putting down hockey sticks or soccer balls or basketballs. We know that. We've seen it. And the numbers, you can call Baseball Canada and ask. Yeah. The registration has been phenomenal. The interest nationwide is there. The Honda Super Camps that tour the country and help teach the finer aspects of the game to kids sell out very, very quickly because so many kids are interested in playing baseball right now. That's what the Blue Jays are doing for baseball in this country.
It's that Raptors effect, right? When you look at you know, those Vince Carter years, and now you get all these kids, you know, Corey Joseph, Tristan Thompson are all like, yeah, I grew up watching the Raptors and Vince Carter, and I wanted to be that.
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of effect.
And there you go. If the Raptors had drafted the best Canadian player instead of Vince Carter, basketball in Canada would probably be worse off now.
I was at a dinner, if I may interject here, at a fundraising dinner in Saskatoon in February.
With Colabello and Pilar, right?
With Chris Colabello, yeah. Kevin Pilar. And the keynote speaker, the star attraction of that dinner was Joe Montana.
Right.
Quite possibly the greatest quarterback in the history of the NFL. This is not to disparage Joe Montana in any way. One of the things they did was they auctioned off the two tables, Joe Montana's table and Kevin Pillar and Chris Colabello's table, to help raise money. In other words, the highest bidders get to sit with Colabello and Pillar. Highest bidders get to sit with Joe Montana. The baseball table generated $4,000 more than the iconic greatest quarterback in the history of the NFL.
Right.
In Saskatoon.
Right.
So that gives you an idea. Now, Joe Montana's heyday was 20 years ago, 15 years ago, right? The Blue Jays are here and now and on your television every single night of the summer and just came off a remarkable run. I get that. But it gives you an idea that baseball is really prominent in this country right now.
One question along those lines for you. When you see those TV audiences just really setting records all of last fall, and you think back to, you know, your days going to sparsely attended games at Exhibition Stadium, is that almost astounding to think that there's so many people watching these games?
No, it's not, because, I mean, when you're as old as I am, you remember those horrible teams, even the first couple of years, 77, 78, when a terrible baseball team would be on the field and it would be, you know, 5 degrees in early May, and still there would be 30,000 people there because, hey, we got baseball. We got big league baseball in Toronto. And then the team became fairly good quite quickly, like 83, 84. They were a pretty good team in 1984, but Detroit was untouchable. And then finally they made the playoffs in 85. They became a good team fairly quickly. So, you know, the sparsely attended games didn't last that long. Huh. And then they were successful even after 85. They were always a competitive team until it finally came to fruition 92, 93. So none of it surprises me. This has always been a great baseball country, not just a city, not just a region, a great baseball country. Great support, tremendous passion, not surprised in the least. I can't imagine anybody would be.
Right.
I have to admit, I was a little surprised. I didn't know that there was that much capacity.
At the television ratings?
Yeah.
Really? Well, I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm not. Because, I mean, wherever you go in this country, people seem to love the Blue Jays.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and you've seen it on winter tours. I mean, you've been basically coast to coast.
It's insane.
So you go to these malls where people are lining up at 4 a.m. to
St. John's, Newfoundland.
Yeah, J.P. Arcibia's autograph,
sure.
Right?
Like, St. Yeah. John's, Newfoundland to meet Eric Thames, for goodness sake. They waited 3 hours because the plane was delayed 3 hours coming out of Halifax.
Wow.
900 people stayed in line an additional 3 hours for Eric Thames. Now, Roberto Alomar was there too, but I always like to use Eric Thames. But.
Have you seen his stats?
It's insane.
In Korea last year? Can I just read you some Eric Thames stats?
Yeah, you
from,
go.
And, from and, Korea
and,
last
and
year?
And when's his contract up there?
Well, I think he's got one more year.
I believe. Last year, Eric Thames had 595 plate appearances. That's a season. 47 home runs, 140 RBIs, 40 stolen bases somehow. He walked 103 times. He had a triple slash line, batting average 381, OBP 497. This guy got on base in half of his at bats.
Yeah.
Slugging 790, OPS of 1.288.
So maybe we'll see him back in the big leagues.
What?
At some point.
He's Barry Bonds.
Yeah. The man. And he spends quite a bit of his offseason here in Toronto too.
Does he?
Oh yeah.
I know.
Yeah,
that. He's not. From, did he meet a girl here or something? He's not,
it's Toronto, for goodness sake. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, when you're Eric Thames, I guess. Sure. Also, to go back to that 2008 MLB draft, Brett Laurie selected 16th.
16th.
By the Milwaukee Brewers.
And who went 17th?
David Cooper.
Okay, nice. I was right. Toronto Blue Jays. So we'll never know, because the Blue Jays are never going to say, oh no, we really wanted David Cooper. They may have had eyes on Brett Laurie, but the Brewers took him. So they took David Cooper. Right. And I think the same thing happened last year. I think Mike Soroka was taken one spot ahead of Jonathan Harris.
Right. Selected 11th.
I don't have a computer in front of me, so I can't look it up.
I can look it up for you, but you're probably right. Selected 11th overall in the 2008 MLB draft. Justin Smoak out of South Carolina.
Wow.
Justin Smoak by the Texas Rangers, 11th overall in the 2008 MLB draft. Now basically a bench piece for the Blue Jays.
Goes back to the point about prospects, huh? He was can't miss.
It goes back to that. And we were talking about Brett Laurie. And I was this morning, actually, when I was like, quote unquote, preparing for this, I was just looking some stuff up on YouTube and I came across this great clip. You and Zonnie are in Tampa with Brett Laurie, JP Arencibia, Travis Snyder.
In a limo.
Yeah, I've seen this.
Yeah,
that's on YouTube?
They're high-fiving and the whole deal, that's out there.
Arencibia. Laurie and Snyder.
And the theme of the piece was like, here's the future of the Toronto Blue Jays. This is like a couple of years ago.
even then, that was a frosty ride
really?
From their house to the arena with respect to Greg.
With Zonnie?
Yeah. Because Greg, you know how Greg is with young players. It's like, you know what? Show me that you've done something before I'll become impressed by you.
And
I remember I was the conversationalist. Greg just sat there and waited until we got to the hockey rink. And I was like, so guys, how are things? Man, I remember that very well. And the best part was, it was only Laurie and Arencibia who were supposed to come with us to this Tampa Bay Lightning game. And we showed up at their house and Snyder lives there. Right. And he comes up to me and says, you mind if I come along? And I'm like, sure, it's a big limousine. Hop in, you know? Wow. I think we can find you an extra hockey ticket, in fact.
So I can think of no better demonstration than like how quickly this game changes and how how fast guys go through this blender.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like this line to the slaughterhouse that is baseball.
Absolutely. Basically,
have you over your time, and this is something that I'm just learning now, but over your time in the game, do you approach kind of when Kevin Pillar has a breakout year last year? I think he called that a breakout year, probably, like defensively, certainly, right? Mm-hmm. When Marcus Stroman comes along and he looks phenomenal in however many starts he's made, do you approach it more cautiously, just having seen, the kind of the cycle?
You mean expectations?
Yeah.
Depends on who the person is, right? And Kevin Pillar, I have spent a lot of time with Kevin Pillar this offseason.
Right.
He gives a crap. Like, he's got this burning passion for this game. A burning passion. And it's so evident. And you don't often see that. Well, I shouldn't say it. I'll take that back. You don't always see that.
Right.
Just because you're a professional ball player doesn't mean that you burn for the game. And I know, look, I love Colby Rasmus too, but I'm not convinced that he just woke up every single morning trying to figure out what can I do to be the best baseball player on the planet.
Right.
He may have, and I got along great with Colby.
Yeah.
But I always got the sense he was doing it for something else. Kevin Pillar lives and breathes the game. It's his driven purpose to be the best at baseball he possibly can be. So he may in 2016 not live up to expectation. He may not be, I doubt he's going to regress defensively, and he may not be the hitter we want him to be, or he might. I don't know. Maybe he'll have just as good a year, and maybe he'll be even better. We'll know. at some point. But the truth is, he's not there to fail, right? And it's not hard to figure that out. If you spend enough time with certain guys, it's not hard to figure out where their priorities lie.
You did the Kevin Pillar show with Pillar as well, right? You did that. And so you've done a lot of stuff with this guy. And he's a guy that I think Blue Jays fans, or at least, well, I don't know, maybe, I think a lot of Blue Jays fans have bought into him, but maybe kind of those who are more statistically inclined have been a bit, slower to kind of accept Kevin Pillar as a major league hitter.
For obvious reasons. He was never a high draft pick. He was taken in the 32nd round.
Yeah.
He was always tabbed as a fourth outfielder at best.
Right.
And he got the job last year because Dalton Pompey gave it up.
Yeah.
You know, Dalton Pompey couldn't hack it. I mean, I'm sorry to be so blunt, but he played scared, as he fully admitted at some point early on in the season. And by default, Kevin Pillar took the job, and now it's his. I think we in the media tend to very quickly label people based on where they're selected in a draft, or where they're positioned on somebody's depth chart, or what Baseball America thinks of them. And we don't allow the evolution of a player to take place. But to know Kevin is to know that he's got an incredibly strong desire to be a master at his craft. And the best part is, most of the guys on this roster think the same way, because we had some great conversations about them going down to Tulowitzki's house in Nevada and them getting together early in Florida and talking about baseball and talking about mechanics and going over hitting and discussing the game and not worrying about. Chris Colabello tells a great story about two teammates with the Minnesota Twins when he just came up, who were so immersed in what they were going to do financially with the money they were going to make in big league baseball, that they were talking about it as they're being introduced on opening day at Target Field, as they're running out to the baselines. And this is a guy who was new to the major leagues, and he was appalled. Right. He was appalled that two players, after spending 7 years in independent baseball, were way more concerned with their financials than they were about what are we going to do to win this game in front of a packed house here in Minneapolis, St. Paul. I mean, the Blue Jays are full of guys who give a crap, whose sole purpose every day is, what do I need to do to win this game tonight? And that's a great thing. If they lose this year, it won't be for lack of effort. I can assure you that.
And it's interesting with guys like Donaldson, who, as Arden has written, has collected baseball cards. I always find that anecdote about him to be very interesting. Tulowitzki grew up watching Ripken and watching Jeter. So clearly these guys are really baseball first. They're obsessed with baseball. You know, do you think that translates for guys? Like, do guys who really love baseball, do they end up faring better on the field, or staying on the field more, or having an edge over other guys?
They must, because you've been around it enough to know how much of a grind it is, right? It's the same way. I've been asked before, what's it like sitting there every single day at the ballpark with Greg Zahn? And I say to anybody who will listen, I feel like a kid. Like, I feel like I'm 10 years old,
right?
And I'm going to Exhibition Stadium for the first time every single day I set foot in that ballpark, which makes it so much easier for me to endure the mid-July Saturday afternoon game in 2011, when they're already 25 games out of first place and it's 90 degrees and I'm wearing a suit, and I've got to watch Zach Stewart get his ass handed to him, right? So, and I mean that sincerely.
Yeah.
In my line of work, I feel like a kid every single day. And that passion for the game allows me to sit there, whether they're a terrible team or a successful team. It's easier when they're successful, but I'm loving every second of it when they're 40 games out of first place, because this is what I've always wanted. And to me, if you're Troy Tulowitzki and you've wanted to be a major league ball player since the day you could even think straight, then how can you not go out there every single day, wherever you're playing, any day of the summer, and not give everything you have to be good at what you do? And I think that's one of the reasons why he's constructed this, you know, borderline Hall of Fame type career, because he gives a rat's ass every single time. and the team is loaded with guys who think exactly the same way.
I think that's part of the reason why, you know, John Gibbons is, I mean, Kevin Pillar is going to be the Blue Jays leadoff hitter. He's not a guy who's, you know, historically gotten on base at, an, you know, at a very good clip. He's a guy who swings the pitches outside the strike zone more often than league average. And, you know, he's probably not that prototypical guy, but I think within that clubhouse, John Gibbons kind of reads how guys are feeling and how guys feel about Kevin Pillar and is saying, no, I need to give it to this guy, even just for the harmony of this team. And you can say that's poor decision-making on the part of the manager, but that's what he's, I think that's a big factor in what he's doing. He's saying, I don't have a Ben Revere type. I don't have a prototypical leadoff hitter on my roster right now. Let's give it to the guy that everyone in this clubhouse is going to be happy to see get that chance. Let's give it to the guy who works his ass off, to, you know what I mean, to get better and to be there. And for a guy that's been, you know, that Troy Tulowitzki really likes and Josh Donaldson really likes and on and on. I think that's a big factor in it.
He might surprise us as a leadoff hitter. I mean, you know, he's a ball player. He's a good one. And he cares about what he does. So maybe this year we'll see a much more patient approach at the plate. Maybe he's recognizing off-speed pitches a little better now that he's 1 year older and 1 year more experienced. And maybe he'll surprise a few people. Maybe his on-base percentage goes up now that he feels that responsibility of being a leadoff hitter. And he won't be down in the eighth hole, you know, hacking away, just trying to scratch out a base hit here or there. I mean, there are a lot of people, as you know, who are sort of poo-pooing this whole idea of Pillar as a leadoff hitter. But let's be frank, they don't have anybody. No. They've got some good on-base guys. They've got Russ Martin, Troy Tulowitzki, guys you could throw up in that spot. But they don't have a legit leadoff type hitter. And frankly, with this, I mean, do they really need a burner in the top spot?
No,
do they really need one? I mean, what's he going to do when he gets to first base?
And Kevin Pillar can run, though. That's
sure, certainly yeah. He can, yeah.
He can absolutely run.
Yeah. Like, Revere was great in that he was a contact hitter. He was able to get on base, but we never saw Ben Revere's ability to steal bases, because why would you possibly do that with Donaldson and Bautista and Encarnacion and the rest of those guys coming up?
And that's the thing with Pillar, is I don't think we're going to see him run as much this year, because if you get a base hit and you're on first base with Bautista or Donaldson, Bautista and Encarnacion, you're probably not going to want to run into it out at second base.
No.
So I think he'll put the brakes on. We saw Revere put the brakes on in a big way. But if Pillar can boost his numbers a little bit from last year, he can put himself in that realm of an average leadoff hitter. Because when you look around Major League Baseball right now, you just don't see a lot of those prototypical leadoff hitters. It's way easier to conceive of one. Mm-hmm. And Nick Ashbourne has a piece about this up on sportsnet.ca now. It's way easier to conceive of one than it is to actually find one. Look around baseball. How many guys actually have that power, that speed and on-base combination?
Mm-hmm.
Right. No, you look at a guy like Billy Hamilton, and everyone's like, wow, if this guy could ever get on base, right?
Yeah.
He could be incredible, but he just can't get on base. You look at Roman Fields, it's got all the speed in the world, but is he going to be able to show a good plate approach? And is he going to be able to get on, you know, take a walk? Is he going to be able to, you know, get pitches to hit? The other thing I would point to is Jose Reyes. So he came over to the Blue Jays in 2013. Over the last 3 years between Toronto and Colorado, Jose Reyes' OBP, 329. Kevin Pillar's last season, 314. So that's a difference of 15 points. If Kevin Pillar could tack 15 points onto that, he's Jose Reyes, and you didn't hear people saying, oh my God, Jose Reyes is our leadoff hitter.
Right.
Everybody was fine with that.
And he can trust his glove and
you can trust
in the field.
Kevin Pillar's
right?
Exactly. Yeah. For sure. You mentioned earlier that...
Also, he's not in jail.
Always a plus for
really a
big
good
league
thing.
Team.
You like to see that on the scouting report. Not in jail.
You
like to see that when it comes up the system. Finally, you said, you know, everybody asks you what it's like to work next to Zon every single day.
It's like. So now you're legitimately asking.
No, yeah. So, well, I mean, it was interesting when you said it's like being a kid, right? And it's like, you know, you get to, you know, soak up the various wisdoms.
It's never boring. Right? It is never boring. You guys know him well, too. It's never boring.
What I wanted to ask, are you enjoying doing that more so than when you were doing play-by-play?
I'm enjoying my role now more than play-by-play for a different reason, and that is that I have kids who need me around.
Yeah.
And with play-by-play, you're never around.
Right.
You know, you're here for 9 days and then you're on the road for 10 and then you're back and kids aren't welcome on the charter and they're not welcome in the clubhouse and they're not welcome in the broadcast booth. So I'm enjoying it for that reason alone. And also, you know, Buck Martinez came on and took over for me in 2010. And as I like to tell people, Buck was playing professional baseball the year I was born.
Right.
So it's pretty hard for me to argue with his credibility, his knowledge. And I think he's done a great job. I think people are going to get absolute enjoyment out of 30 games of Dan Schulman this year, including the home opener, I've been told. So I am fine not being part of the play-by-play crew anymore. And I get to sit with my best friend and tolerate him from time to time and talk baseball with him most of the time. And it's a wonderful experience every day.
I think that might be breaking news on ATL right there.
What's
Dan
that?
Schulman doing opening day.
Oh, well, there you go.
It's the first time we've broken news on this podcast. Glad we got you on.
Sorry, the home opener. Not opening day in Tampa, the home opener Boston.
Yes. Right, which could be a very special day if David Price and Marcus Stroman are both pitching that.
It could be special. Well, no, it's special anyway, right?
Well,
yeah.
But it could go to a whole nother level
if
we're going to see that.
Recent years, the Blue Jays have not done well in the home opener either.
I'm trying to think back. I can't remember. I know last year in the opener, they spanked the Yankees.
Yes. They won 2 of 3 from New York and then won 2 of 3 from Baltimore and came home to face
Tampa, maybe?
And lost. Yeah, they faced Tampa.
Acting like I can't look it up right in front of me right now.
But Tampa Bay.
Tampa Bay. Yeah.
I think they lost.
That as part of that, the weird struggles that the Blue Jays have had against Tampa Bay, which actually kind of finally came to an end a bit last year.
It did.
Stall for time here. Yeah, against Tampa Bay, and they lost 2-1 in the Blue Jays home opener. And then they lost the next day 3-2.
You don't have to look this up, but I don't think the Blue Jays have won a home opener in a while.
Right.
Like, I know, I think the last year I did play-by-play, 09, they destroyed Minnesota.
Right.
But I don't remember them winning a home opener in recent years. I guess I'll have to look it up.
So you mentioned feeling like you're still a kid when you're in the broadcast booth over down the left field line with Zahn. What about when you were actually a kid? When you were going down to Exhibition Stadium, watching the Blue Jays in those early years, like you said, they had some struggles early on, and then they became a pretty good team pretty quickly. What was that experience like for you?
It was obsessive. It got to the point, honestly, when I was probably about 13 or 14, and I lived really close to the GO train station in Oakville, that I would skip out of school and probably get to 30 games a year by myself.
Wow.
Like, I was obsessed. Wow. I was straight. In fact, I cannot believe to this day that my parents, in a non-cell phone era, would allow their 13, 14-year-old son to walk out of the house, leave school early, do whatever I was going to do to get to a particular GO train in Oakville, take that train into downtown Toronto, ride a subway to the hotel where the visiting team was staying, sit in the lobby of that hotel, wait for those players to come down and ask for tickets, bats, autographs, whatever I could. Then as the team boarded the bus and made their way to the exhibition, got on a streetcar, went down to the stadium myself, was first kid in the gate and standing down at the front of the front row for batting practice. Like, that was my routine.
Wow.
And then sit there by myself, usually in the right field seats down near the bullpen until, you know, whatever, 10 o'clock at night on a Tuesday.
Wow.
And then take the GO train home and crawl into the house at 12:45 and be up in time for first class. My parents let me do that and never said a word otherwise.
Would you score the games? What would you do? Would you read the paper on the GO train? What would you do?
No, I never scored games.
Okay.
Never did. Just sat and watched by myself. I was a classic loner. And in my later years, like when I was 16, I started realizing a lot of the people I was sitting with were female who were gifted tickets by many of the bullpen members of the visiting team. And I was in on some fascinating conversations. Fascinating conversations.
Stuff you never thought you'd know about
stuff that was eye-opening for me at 16, right? And stuff that made me realize, man, what are you doing here? Like, why aren't you out at some bush party somewhere? Right? It's Friday night and you're 16 years old and you're sitting at a ball game by yourself. How come you're not back in Oakville with your buds, you know, trying to drink underage or do something? Like, I had some real sort of battles, personal battles sitting at some of those games, because it was fun when I was 12, 13, 14. And then as I got into my later teens, I'm like, you know, when are you going to give this up, dude? Like, when are you going to start acting like a normal 16 to 17 year old kid?
But it would have been, it must have been hard to give up, because it can be addicting, right? Watching baseball, and you can't get away from
terribly addicted. Yeah. And I'm so glad I did it too. I had some great times. I was sitting when Dave Winfield killed the seagull.
Yeah.
I was literally sitting in the front row of the Yankee bullpen. So the seat behind the Yankee bench in their bullpen, and the kid who went out and got the seagull covered in a towel came over and put the seagull on the bench directly in front of me and left it there. And I'm not kidding you. I had this thought. I thought to myself, I should take that seagull right now, put it in my backpack, take it home, have somebody stuff it and mount it, and keep it as a souvenir. I literally thought that.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, my mom would lose her mind if I walked into the house with a dead seagull.
Your parents might have stopped letting you go.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Take that GO train.
They might have kicked you off the GO train with a seagull in your backpack. Yeah.
Wow. But, you know, I had a backpack full of baseball cards. Yeah. And, you know, I'd catch foul balls during BP. And the odd time a player would give me a bat and that kind of thing that I'd be carrying around. And then I'd do it. I did it ceaselessly. And I loved it. I was obsessed with it.
Any interaction that stands out to you?
Dan Quisenberry and I had a wonderful relationship. You remember the quiz? Just a wonderful man, and he died young of cancer. The very first interaction I ever had with a baseball player that stood out was with Lyman Bostock, and it was May of 1977. It was one of the first games I ever went to, and I went down to field level on this gorgeous Saturday sunny afternoon, and there's a Minnesota Twin sitting there minding his own business, and he calls me over and says, "Hey, kid, what's your name?" And I said, "Jamie Campbell." He says, "Nice to meet you. Come over here." He says, "You go to school in the area?" He said, "Yeah, I live in Oakville, not far from here." He says, "That's great." He says, "How many games have you been to this year?" I said, "This is my second." I said, "The first one was rained out." He says, "So I'm actually going to see a real game here." And he said, "Well, it's been nice meeting you." And I said, "You too." And I said, "Would you mind signing my program before I go?" And he goes, "No problem whatsoever." And I just fell in love with this man instantly. And it was Lyman Bostock. And I still have that program, still have that signature. And then a year later, he was murdered in this real tragic misidentity type situation. And I was heartbroken. And I remember hearing it on the radio in September of 1978 that he had been murdered. And I cried like a baby. And it took me weeks to get over that. Wow. Because he was the one player who sort of said, "Hey, you can be close to this game too. You may not be on the field, but you can be close to this game, and you're sort of welcome in my world." I'll never forget that. 1977.
That's amazing.
Yeah, somebody pulled up to his car. I'm reading on Wikipedia right now.
Yeah.
And tried to kill who was in the passenger seat.
Thought his ex-wife was having an affair and figured that Lyman Bostock was that person and shot him in the back of the head. And that guy got off on an insanity plea. He just died about 4 or 5 years ago of cancer, but he never served more than 8 months in jail.
Really?
Yeah. Terrible, terrible situation. And Lyman Bostock was one of the top players in the game at that time. In fact, in 1978, at the time he was playing for the California Angels, he had signed a free agent contract and a big one, you know, $750,000 a year over 3 years, I think it was. And after the first month, he was hitting about 210, and he went to Gene Autry, the owner of the Angels, and said, "I want to give April's money back."
Yeah.
"Like, I want to give a month's pay back to you because I haven't earned it." And Autry said, "I'm not going to take it back. If you want to donate it to charity, go right ahead." And he did.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Says here, thousands of requests came in for the money, and Bostock reviewed each one of them, trying to determine who needed it most.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. There's a story right there. That is, I'd never heard of him before. Yeah.
Well, and when I learned later about him, right, when I dug into who this guy was, it occurred to me, it was not at all surprising that he would turn around on some obscure Saturday in the 1977 season and see some curly redhead kid standing behind him and call him over, right, and have an impact on his life. What? Lyman Bostock will never know the impact he had on my life. Never.
A guy from Birmingham, Alabama. Just, yeah, look, he's got a great mustache on him. Looks like here on his baseball reference page. Looks like a beauty. Yeah.
Read a story. Read a story. There's a documentary that runs on MLB Network from time to time about Lyman Bostock. If you can catch it, I highly encourage it. He was an incredible person.
That's one of the things about baseball that attracts me to it, is that it does seem to attract these characters, like these unbelievable, like just like even you look at like Josh Donaldson, what a character. Jose Bautista, what a character, right? Like what personalities, just the guys that play this game. And cause it's an insane thing to do. 162 in 180 is crazy. It's absurd. It's nuts. It's a crazy thing to do. And the amount of failure you have to put up with in this game, you know what I mean? Where if you fail 7 times out of 10, you're good. Like that, like it's pretty, it's remarkable. And so it does attract like a certain type of personality. It sounds like Lyman Bostock kind of had that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a gift. It's a gift to anybody who appreciates baseball for all that it is, for the statistics, for the numbers, for the stories, for the history, for the way the game is played, for the nuances of the game itself, for pitch to pitch, at bat to at bat, everything. It's an absolute gift. It's a wonderful thing being a passionate baseball fan. It really is.
Greg Zahn, what a character.
What's he got to do with it?
You got anything else, Ben?
No, I think that's a great note to end on.
That's a nice little place to end.
Yeah.
Can we plug anything for you, Jamie? You want to? Oh, Pitch Talks.
Pitch Talks on Thursday. Ottawa at a place that I can't pronounce.
And I'm going to look it up right now. Zaphod's Bebop. Do you know what that is?
It's a bar.
Oh, I guess you've been there?
Yes. More than once.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you went to Carlton.
Yeah.
You went to Carlton. Yeah. So tell us about Zaphod's.
Well, I mean, I'm sure it'll be a lot of fun. It sounds like there'll be some hockey talk, some baseball talk. I imagine some beers will be flowing. I will not be there, but you guys will.
I will be, and I think we're last to go, which means I'll be inebriated by the time I start speaking.
I'll just try to keep up.
Right?
All right. Well, I'll join you in that mission.
I'm going to another place on Elgin when it's over, so you're more than welcome to join me.
Do you want to plug the after party, the official Jamie Campbell after party? I think
it's called the Lieutenant's Pump.
The Lieutenant's Pump.
What brings you to spot?
I used to live in Ottawa, and I used to hang out there, and I haven't been there in 20 years, so I'm going.
Well, it sounds like we're all going to Lieutenant's Pump after.
Awesome. It's a good place.
So Thursday night, if you are in Ottawa, come out. You can see me. You can see Jamie Campbell. You can't see Ben Nixon-Smith, although he has been advertised as being there. You can't see him. You can see Richard Griffin, fine columnist for Toronto Star. You can see the Tao Steeb, another Sportsnet contributor.
I don't know how blogger. I'm getting there. So if anybody sees me standing on the side of the 401 with my thumb out, would you kindly give me a ride?
I think you'll find some people who are more than happy. You might not enjoy the ride, but you'll find some people who are more than happy. So at Zaphod Beeblebrox, is that it?
I think it just goes by Zaphod.
Just Zaphod? Yeah,
there we go.
Yeah. What kind of bar is it? What are we talking about here?
I haven't been there in a couple of years.
It's so one that sells alcohol.
Exactly. That's the important thing.
And then later in the night, we're going to go for pizza with gravy on it.
Okay.
Which is also an Ottawa thing. Do you remember that? There's a place on Elgin at 1 o'clock in the morning that sells pizza and puts beef gravy on the pizza. And trust me, man, it's awesome.
Oh, wow.
It's awesome.
It doesn't get soggy.
Especially after you've had about 10 pints, it's really good.
It doesn't get, you can't not pick it up.
No, they put it on it right away. Like, here's your slice.
Yeah.
And here it is now. Now we're pouring beef gravy on it.
Right.
I forget the name of the place because, like I said, I haven't partied on Elgin Street in 25 years, but I'm going and I know where it is. So you can come too if you'd like.
Ben, I think you just come anyway.
This is quite a sales pitch. I'm being convinced right here and now.
Back to the old stomping grounds.
It sounds like a lot of fun.
A young Ben Nicholson-Smith used to tear it up at Zaphod's.
Oh, I wouldn't go that far, but I did enter the doors anyways.
there's also a Puck Talks there that night. So CJ is going to be, Chris Johnston is going to be there. Shannon Proudfoot of Sportsnet Magazine will be there. She's a really insightful person. I'm furiously trying to find the thing right now. But yeah, just come out. It'll be a good time.
Yeah. If you live in Ottawa.
If you live in Ottawa. Even if you don't.
If you live in Winnipeg, doesn't mean you have to drive to Ottawa. Just if you live in Ottawa, please join us.
Here we go. Ian Mendez, Sean McKindo, and Bruce Garioch.
Garioch.
Garioch?
Yeah.
There you go.
Who knows? Ottawa Sun.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
You worked in Ottawa?
Yes, I did. That what it was? For CJOH TV.
When was
1997.
That? Oh, really? How was that experience?
Fantastic. I was going to stay there long term too, but suddenly this network called Sportsnet came to life, and
you're day one.
I got lured. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Show one.
Show one.
Wow. Show one.
Show number two, technically. Sunil Joshi hosted the very first show on Sportsnet, and me and Darren Millard hosted number two.
Wow.
Yeah, we were young men back then.
Still are, frankly.
Not quite. I'm almost 50.
You don't like it.
Thank you.
I'll give you that.
That'd be the hot yoga.
I think it's definitely the hot yoga.
Which I did before I came to do this podcast.
Did you really?
Absolutely.
I thought you were wearing some yoga apparel there, right? Look at you.
Yeah, no, I changed. Believe me, you sweat about 8 pounds.
Do you?
Oh, yeah. It's amazing.
Ben?
Good. Buck Martinez did it last year.
It's intense.
Really?
I've done it once.
Buck did it.
Buck did it with all you? Of last off season. He showed really? Up at spring training last year like 20 pounds slimmer. And I said, Buck, what happened? And he said, hot yoga.
Have you done it with him?
No. Goodness, no. No.
I mean, I love Buck. I've seen him walk. Right. Flexibility and Buck aren't things that I typically would line up together.
Covering new ground on At the Letters today.
Yes, we are. Well, I've never been a guest on At the Letters, so.
And thanks for being on.
Oh.
We appreciate it. I think people are going
to. I'd like to come back.
Yeah, we'll have you back.
Oh, yeah.
I think people will dig this. Some more stories about dead seagulls and
dead baseball players apparently, too. Yeah.
That seagull story is so good. It's awesome.
You'd still have it. It'd be on your wall.
How much do you think it'd be worth?
It's pretty.
Are we going over time here?
One of
the
kind. Sam's been in my ear forever. I kind of like to piss Sam off and just
think about it though. If I had the stuffed and mounted seagull that Dave Winfield killed, I could probably get about $10,000 for it. You know, yeah. I think
there's got to be some like
charity auction.
Sure.
For charity. Everyone bid on this dead bird.
Of course, where you'd end up with some kind of letter of authenticity is beyond me.
Yeah,
you just take my word for it.
Yeah, exactly. This isn't just a seagull that I found, on the streets of Oakville. This is legit. I don't know. It's one. There's got to be some eccentric like collector out there who would be like, I need to have that dead bird. I need to have it. What a place to end. Dead birds, dead ball players. Very alive, Jamie Campbell. Thank you for coming out.
Thank you for having me.
It was great. For Jamie, for Ben Nixon Smith, I'm Arden Zwelling. Thanks for coming along on At the Letters.